A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these arts organizations. Today, we'll hear about a new documentary that explores the life and legacy of the legendary singer Marian Anderson. The film, set to air this month on PBS stations, traces her determination to forge a career in singing, the racist barriers she faced at home in the U.S., and the role that she and her performance at the Lincoln Memorial played in changing attitudes toward civil rights. My guest will be the film's producer, Rob Rapley. Let's start off with a look at some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. The shift to online seasons has ramped up as possible timelines for returning to in-person performances continue to be pushed back. The San Francisco Symphony announced the launch of a new on-demand streaming service called SF Symphony Plus, which will feature both paid original content and some free content through August. Among the new productions include chamber music performances, episodes highlighting Indian classical, Persian, klezmer, American Indian, and Zimbabwean musical cultures, and a Chinese New Year virtual celebration. The service also includes content from the symphony's Soundbox series that emphasizes new music programs curated by music director Esa-Pekka Salonen and other contemporary composers. New online programming also continues to expand to include performances for young people. The Pittsburgh Symphony this spring is launching a new set of concerts and resources for educators called Virtual School Time. A revision of the orchestra's traditional school concert program, the series includes units on musical storytelling, the orchestra, chamber music, and composition, and will also feature a virtual field trip. And the Boston Symphony announced a partnership with the city's public schools through which it will release a series called Meet the Instruments with the BSO, masterclasses, and other online teaching videos. The symphony also plans to release its first BSO Youth Concert stream March 5th, offering it free to students in Boston and Berkshire County Public Schools. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. The legendary singer Marian Anderson is perhaps best known for her historic performance at the Lincoln Memorial on Easter Sunday in 1939, held in response to the refusal by the DAR to let her perform at its Constitution Hall because of its whites-only performer policy. Known as the Voice of a Century, inspired by a comment by conductor Arturo Toscanini, Anderson still faced the hurdles of racist policies and sentiments throughout her education and career. One element explored in the new documentary that will be released this month on PBS. Called Voice of Freedom and part of PBS's American Experience series, the documentary traces Anderson's persistence and determination as she followed her musical dreams, which in turn made her both a musical star and, in her own way, a civil rights pioneer. Rob Rapley is the film's producer, and I spoke with him about Anderson's story of both challenge and triumph.
Always topical, the history of civil rights in this country. But when we started 2 years ago, we didn't realize quite how topical it would be. You know, Anderson, as you suggested, has really been reduced not even to her music, but to a few iconic photographs of her at the Lincoln Memorial. And she really was so much more than that. And she was so much more than a singer, really. She, like every black celebrity then and now, had to kind of decide what her relationship was going to be to the civil rights movement, which we think of as starting in 1955. But, of course, it was always there and certainly kind of came into being as her career was beginning after the First World War. And so her career really kind of is follows two different streams. There's her career as an artist, and then there's this parallel story of her kind of relationship to the movement for civil rights in this country.
Looking at her life, one of the first times that the walls are put up for her in terms of, based on being Black, was precisely when she was trying to step in and get to the education, the music education that she knew she wanted and she knew she needed. Tell us a little bit about that moment when she applies to the Academy and how she deals with that.
Well, Anderson had really stood out as a singer from an early age. She joined the church choir at Union Baptist, which was one of the big churches in Philadelphia, when she was 6 years old, and had kind of become a bit of a star locally. And it was the only thing that she was interested in from a very young age. She knew, and other people told her that someday you're going to be a musician. And so she actually had to leave school entirely after the eighth grade because her father passed away in an accident at work, and she had to help support the family. So her entire education was interrupted for 3 years, but then her community and her church community in particular raised money for her to go to high school because they saw this, one of their favorite daughters of the congregation and obviously a standout talent kind of being slowly crushed by the financial realities of her life. And so they raised money to help her go to high school, but also to get a musical education. But when she went to apply, she sat in the lobby of what we believe was the Philadelphia Musical Academy all day while white girls were ushered past. And then finally she went up to the receptionist and said, I'm here to apply. And the woman said, according to Anderson, we don't take colored. And it was, a staggering blow for Anderson. She had grown up in, as much as any place in America was kind of tolerant in about race at the beginning of the 20th century. Her neighborhood was, she played with the Irish girls up the street. She went to a mixed race school, an integrated school, and so on. And so this actually was a shock to her. It's not as if she'd never heard of Jim Crow, of course. And she, there were many instances of it in Philadelphia, but something like this was a real shock to her. And her kind of search for education would be the dominant story of her life for the next 20 years or so, that her remarkable talent was limited by her lack of education. She had a wonderful voice, a staggering voice, but, you need training to become a real singer, and she couldn't get that. And that dogged her always. It's interesting when you listen to the interview she did with her biographer that she sounds like a diva. She's very, very self-assured and very, she has a regal manner. But then every time something about education comes up, she all of a sudden sounds kind of a little deferential. And clearly, even at this stage in her 60s, or 50s or 60s, she was still conscious of that lack of education, even though in musical terms, she'd more than made up for it by going to Europe.
It seems that her life is dogged in some ways by timing and timing of these events that were bringing race to the forefront of national headlines. One of her first major singing debuts was marred to a certain extent by the riots and the unrest in Chicago. How did she deal with that? What were some of the things that she reflected on after those plans had to change, and yet she still walked out of that with a level of recognition that was starting to be due?
Yeah, as you mentioned, her first real debut was at an event sponsored by the National Association of Negro Musicians. It was their inaugural meeting in Chicago in 1919. And as it happened, as Anderson was preparing for the concert, The city blew up in one of the worst racial conflicts in the country's history. You know, just 3 days, and it was just an appalling event. And she, that was her debut, kind of took place in this context. But it's really interesting. You know, she doesn't mention, she never mentions that in her interviews, she responded to that by focusing on the music, that she wanted to be an artist. And, you know, and this is kind of where you decide you become somebody like Paul Robeson, who's going to, you know, really put that mission front and center, or someone like Anderson, who focuses on being an artist and proving to the world that she is an artist and that she deserves to be, you know, on that stage with anybody else, and the music of African-American composers and spirituals and so on also deserves a place on the stage alongside the music of Bach and Mozart and so on. That is kind of her assertion of her nobility, really, as an individual, when that was exactly what was being taken from African-Americans. And so she doesn't address it directly, but she, in her music, is actually very active in promoting, as I say, the music of African-American composers and sponsoring compositions and so on, and especially in promoting spirituals, the kind of classical arrangements of spirituals.
Now, her time in Europe was very different in terms of the way she was perceived, the way she was received, and also the fact that it gave her the opportunity to explore some of the education that she still wanted to achieve. How did that then influence her career as far as the opportunity she had in Europe that she didn't have here?
Her career was really made in Europe, that she just kept running into roadblocks here and just could not progress beyond a certain level, no matter what she did. And so in 1927, she went to Europe, and in London and then in Berlin, you know, studied with the best teachers in the world. And it was a dream come true. And it was hard, you know, Europe was hardly free of racism, as, the world would soon see. But especially, she did several tours of Scandinavia, and there was a certain amount of kind of exoticism or whatever about her, that, you know, curiosity. But that's very different from what she'd become accustomed to in her tours of the Upper South, especially. And so it was very liberating, and she really you get this wonderful sense from her retelling of the story of just how liberating it was for her. And as a result, she really blossomed as an artist, and in fairly short order, after a few years of study, really became a major star in Europe. And she was playing the biggest halls in Paris and Berlin and London and as far afield as Moscow. And then finally, you know, as the racism was really starting to rear its head, especially in Germany with the rise of the Nazis in the mid-30s, the whole feeling of Europe changes. And it's not just for Jews, although, of course, that's the dominant story. But being a person of color, any minority in Germany, was getting to be a dangerous thing. And so she was effectively banned from Germany just because she was black, and was barred from the Salzburg Music Festival in Austria, because Austria was already kind of very much heavily influenced by the Nazis. And she sang there anyways, during the festival, but not as part of the festival, at a concert in a hotel ballroom. And it was attended by all the most glittering stars of the classical world, or at least the anti-fascist ones. And they included Arturo Toscanini, who was then by far the most famous conductor in the world. And he, after the concert, went backstage and told her, words to the effect of, you have a voice that is heard once in 100 years. And that became her catchphrase. She became, from that day forward, thanks to her very deft agent, the voice of the century. That was her tagline. And and so when she returned to America soon afterward, she came back as a huge star and was just one sold out concert after another. And they almost couldn't keep up with the demand. It was so the difference between her departure as a frustrated, you know, student in 1927 and her return as a huge star in 1935, that really is due to what happened in Europe.
Then that leads to one of the next major events, which is again a key element and centerpiece of the film and her life, is that concert at the Lincoln Memorial. It wasn't originally obviously what she had planned, and she had a lot of discomfort with that. How did that crystallize in terms of the way it represented the way that racism had been defining her life throughout her career?
You know, the concert started, the seeds were planted when she was denied the use of the only really suitable concert hall in Washington by the Daughters of the American Revolution, who owned the place. And her cause was taken up by Howard University and by the NAACP. And while Anderson was away on tour over the course of several months, this controversy kind of grew and grew and then became a huge national story because Eleanor Roosevelt kind of wrote about it in her column and resigned from the Daughters of the American Revolution. And it became a kind of riveting national story. And, you know, from the outside, we see as America is starting to define itself in opposition to Nazism, that racism is kind of is taking on a different kind of tone, that it's not as accepted as it was. And so people who want to make a statement about Nazism, you know, this is an opportunity for them. But as you suggest, Anderson wasn't really, she hadn't been involved in those decisions at all, and she was extremely uncomfortable with it, very apprehensive, precisely because she'd never aspired to be a political icon an icon of the movement. She wanted to be a musician who advocated for change in through her music and her artistry, and she knew that this was going to change everything. I don't think anybody realized quite how big it was going to be, but obviously it was going to eclipse, or it risked eclipsing her career as a musician. Even the night before, she called her agent to ask if she had to go through with this, and, you know, her agent, I'm sure, was, you know, yeah, you do. You know, there are tens of thousands of people are coming tomorrow. It's going to be coast-to-coast radio broadcast. This is the biggest thing anybody's ever been involved in. Yes, you do have to go through with it. And I think it was during the concert that she, I wouldn't say necessarily had an epiphany, but you can see and hear in the performance and in her very brief speech to the audience at the end, just how moved she was by the whole thing. And it really was a remarkable 75,000 people coming out in the cold for hours to watch an African-American woman sing. It's unremarkable now, but in 1939, that was, you know, when you place it in the context of its times, that's a really remarkable thing. But then, you know, in the aftermath, it really did come to define her, and she didn't speak about it for decades, really. And when she, 16 years later, when she was doing interviews for her memoir, she had a big fight with the publisher because she didn't want them to mention the Lincoln Memorial Concert, you know. So it would be like the Marian Anderson story minus the Lincoln Memorial Concert. And again, you have to put it in the context of 1955. That this is, the civil rights movement was only the modern civil rights movement was only just getting underway, and it was an extremely racist time. I think that by the 60s and 70s, she really felt quite different about it, but it took that long that, you know, she was by then in her late 60s or early 70s, and that's when I think she finally really embraced it and came to terms with this thing that had that she'd been kind of involved in without meaning to do so, and had changed the course of her life.
Well, as you were working on this, what were some of the resources and sources that you had available that were particularly helpful in pulling together this picture of her as an artist?
The really, really fascinating source was actually the interviews that she did with Harold Tubman, of then the music critic of the New York Times, in 1955. She agreed to basically have a memoir published. It would be ghostwritten by Tubman, and they did hours and hours of interviews. Now, when the memoir was published, it was called My Lord, What a Morning. It was under her name, and that became kind of the standard account of her life for decades. But then, I think about 10 years ago, one of the people that we interview in the film, Sharon Vreen, found the transcripts of the interviews that she had done and realized that there were discrepancies between what Anderson had said and what Tubman had written. For the most part, they weren't egregious, and I don't think Tubman intended to change anything, but he did, and especially when it came to Anderson's to anything that touched on race relations, and her stories of her childhood in Philadelphia and so on, and so she wrote about that, and we actually got access not only to the transcripts but to the tapes of the interviews, and they're just such a fascinating source, because it is actually kind of difficult to get to know Anderson. She was very guarded for obvious reasons. She didn't let the world in. And even in these interviews, for the most part, a lot of talk about what dress she was wearing and what her hat looked like and so on. And kind of anecdotes don't really pay off. But here and there you get just really precious glimpses into her real self. And so that really was the core of our, the most important source by far. And we quote Anderson, we have an actress read excerpts from those tapes, because the tapes themselves, the audio wasn't good enough to use, really. But those words are Anderson's words. They're not from the memoir. They're not, from transcribed from any other source. Those are actually the words that she used, and that's the first time that's been done.
And what additional commentary or historians, musicologists that you have commenting throughout the documentary, what did they bring to help tell part of this story?
Oh, so much. It's the nature of this form that it's really kind of a collective effort in putting this story together. Adrienne Lynn Smith, for example, an historian at Duke, she really helped place Anderson in the context of her time and in her relationship to the civil rights movement, which was just such a key to the story, the different people brought different things to it. Alida Black, is a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, so she brought that angle to it. Angela Brown is a soprano herself, and she was on the front page of the Times when she debuted at the Met. Alicia Jones, a wonderful musicologist, and Denise Van Buren, who's the president general of the Daughters of the American Revolution now, gave us their perspective, and it's the first time that they've really discussed it publicly, the DAR. And I was struck by the fact that nobody who's written about this had ever contacted the DAR, and And again, coincidentally, the woman who had been the president general of the DAR in 1939 when this happened had passed away a few years ago, and her papers had just been donated to the DAR, and we were given complete and unfettered access to those papers and to all of their archives, and it was a tremendously valuable resource because they kept not just their own correspondence and so on, but all of the just hundreds and hundreds of newspaper articles. So we, you know, really gave us a complete picture of the thing. And so it was, I think, very useful to, you know, they are not interested in exonerating the DAR of 1939, but just in telling the story in context, I think it was something that has dogged the DAR certainly ever since. I appreciate their kind of being willing to kind of shed more light on this story without trying to shape it in any way.
What did you learn? You have a classical music background of your own. What did you learn and take away from doing this about Marian Anderson that you hadn't before, that maybe something that surprised you?
I guess, so much. The thing that I think was almost the key to the story was her apprehension about the concert. That, the thing that would come to define her life, that she was so ambivalent about it. She was apprehensive beforehand and ambivalent afterwards. And so kind of getting into that, kind of exploring that. And, you know, you realize that it wasn't because she had any reservations about civil rights or her own, you know, right to do what she was doing or anything. She had struggled so hard to be a musician. It's really hard for anybody to become a professional musician, and for a young black woman in the 19-teens and 20s, it was almost impossible. Just an incredible feat. And having done that, to kind of have control of it taken away from you, it was very interesting to see what she conceived of as her own role in the movement as an artist, and against this kind of larger movement that was going on and taking shape in that same period.
That was Rob Rapley, producer of the documentary Voice of Freedom about Marian Anderson. The film premieres February 15th at 9 p.m. on PBS stations, and you can check local listings and pbs.org for more details. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you, focusing on the changing dynamics in the arts world each week on iTempo. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support of the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.